WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending part of your day with us. The holidays are a time when many people seek to give back and help those in need. And certainly in a city of more than 8.5 million people, there's no shortage of ways to help your fellow New Yorkers. If you're trying to figure out where to donate or volunteer your time this holiday season, we've got some good news for you. It's never too late. Our friends at Curbed have compiled a list of local charities and community groups. Curbed's New York editor, Amy Plitt, puts it all together, and she's going to walk us through it. Thanks for coming to the studio, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me.
And listeners, we do want to hear from you. Our number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Do you want to shout out a local charity that deserves recognition for the work that it does? Or do you want to give us a way to help your fellow listeners or your fellow New Yorkers? 212-433-9692. So, Amy, you're an organized person. You split it into two categories.
Yeah.
Donate and volunteer. Let's start with NYC Books Through Bars program. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got books laying around that they just think could have a new home.
Yeah, absolutely. And NYC Books Through Bars started in 1996, so they've been doing this for, you know, about 20 years now. They donate books to incarcerated men and women in New York. You know, it's not always easy to get books into prisons, so they go out of their way to make sure that people are getting the reading material that they want and need. That being said, you can't take any book there. They don't accept hardcovers. They have a pretty strict list of books that are allowed to be donated. They always want dictionaries. They always want mass market paperback fiction books. They especially want historic fiction or even histories that deal with African-American history, Latino history, things like that. But a great thing they do that's really easy for people who want to donate to them is they have a wish list through Greenlight Bookstore in Brooklyn, and you can just go on Greenlight's website and find a book that you would want to send to a person, and it's just as easy as that.
You mean like a new book? Like if I want to buy a book and send it, or?
Yeah, you know, I think they'll take a book from Greenlight, just a paperback that's on their wish list, and you can send it. It's like doing an Amazon wish list, but doing some good.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's
very
great.
Cool. University Settlement is one of New York's more historic nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
What do they do?
Yeah, they've been around for more than 130 years. They started on the Lower East Side. They still have a community center on the Lower East Side. They do a lot of help with New York families. So things like early childhood care, youth programs like mentorship. They also do a lot with older New Yorkers, like adult literacy programs and helping elderly New Yorkers at their community centers. So you can volunteer for any of those kinds of things.
Oh, just be like a, just to be the helper. That's not necessarily a money or a thing.
Yeah, I mean,
it's an opportunity to actually be there and engage.
Yeah, you can do that. You can donate money too, though, and that's always always helpful.
One of the things I think sort of interesting is, and you didn't cover this, but I'm guessing you can answer this question.
Sure.
That when you're volunteering, there's a certain kind of, I don't know, is etiquette the right word? Or a certain sort of attitude to bring. I bring this up because I was volunteering at a, I don't want to say the organization, at a Thanksgiving. And there was a woman there with her kid. And all she kept saying was like, can you sign this community service? Can you sign this community service? And that seemed to be the thrust of her reason for being there was to her son's community service. And it was making me absolutely crazy.
Yeah, I think that's probably not the way to behave. I mean, you know, you don't want to treat people as if they are lesser than you. You want to make sure you're emphasizing the dignity of the people that you're helping and treating them just like New Yorkers. You know, even though they might need a little more help than you, that doesn't mean you should just treat it as a transactional thing. Get to know them, talk to them, find out like what makes this person tick.
We're talking to Amy Plitt, editor at Curbed New York. She's coming to the studio to help us figure out ways that we can help our fellow New Yorkers who need assistance this holiday season. Our number here is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Maybe you know of a local charity that deserves recognition for the work that it does, or you want to offer a way to help fellow New Yorkers. Maybe you know something, someplace we can volunteer. 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. NYC. Okay, we all see coat drive ads. Mm-hmm. Is there one main organization that takes care of this, or is this, are these satellite organizations?
So New York Cares is the organization that does the main big coat drive that people probably know. It's advertised on the subway. You probably mm-hmm. have walked past one of its donation centers because they have them in Grand Central Terminal and Penn Station. So that's the one that people are really familiar with. It's been going on for 30 years now. And this year, they're hoping to collect and distribute 130,000 coats. To 130,000 coats to New Yorkers. And the great thing about this is you can donate, like I said, at Penn Station or at Grand Central, which, you know, every New Yorker pretty much passes through during the holiday season if you have a gently used coat. Mm-hmm. They also take them at NYPD precincts, so you can do it there. And you can also look on New York Cares' website and find a donation center that might be near you.
And it has to be gently worn. Any other?
Gently worn, clean. They always emphasize that they need coats for children and coats that are sizes XL or above. So, you know, anything you might have laying in your closet will probably work as long as it's not bad condition. But those are the things they're always kind of looking for the most.
I remember another place I worked, they always said if you wouldn't necessarily, if you wouldn't wear it yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the condition you could consider. Mm-hmm. Even if it's slightly worn, would you wear this out? Would you put this on your own child?
Right.
So that should be your sort of your threshold.
That's a good way to look at it.
Can people still contribute to New York Cares in other ways?
Yeah. I mean, one of the great things is if you don't actually have a coat to donate, you can just text coat, the word coat, to the number 41444. And this information is on New York Cares' website. But you can text them and they'll, you know, get back to you and ask you for a financial donation. And $20, they say, provides one coat to a New Yorker through their organization. So you can donate funds and know that you're helping in that way.
Would you say that again, just for folks who maybe ran to get a pencil?
Yeah. You text the word coat, COAT, to the number 41444, and that will hook you up with a text donation thing from New York Cares.
Okay. We have a caller on line one, Nell from Manhattan. Nell wanted to add something to the conversation. Hi, Nell.
Hi. You know, I heard from charities in the past that what they have plenty of volunteers, most of them, for this last couple of weeks of the year, but that what really would be helpful is volunteers starting in the new year, and also just to emphasize that a check, that they can use a check and it can go much further because they can buy things in bulk at a cheaper rate, and it's kind of uses their resources less. So I don't want to discourage anybody, but I'm wondering if the person could talk about that the needs continue year round. And that they're not really in such great need, at least for volunteers, in the last couple of weeks of the year.
Nell, thank you so much for calling in. Does Nell have a, is that true? There's a drop off?
Yeah, I mean, I think people think about giving back this time of year because naturally we're talking about giving and, you know, giving spirit and all that stuff. So it's top of mind right now, but it's really important, like Nell said, to continue doing this throughout the year because this isn't the only time of year when people need help in New York. It's really important to continue that that giving spirit throughout the year. And oftentimes, yes, charities will say it's better to donate money than supplies or even trying to like come in during such a busy time of year because they can't make that go further.
We're talking to Amy Plitt, editor at Curb New York. She's put together this amazing list of places where you can make donations and places where you can also volunteer this time of year. And as we've just said, all year long. If you want to join the conversation, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. So Housing Works, a lot of people know about Housing Works. But for those who don't, who are they and what can we give to Housing Works?
Yeah, so Housing Works was founded in 1990. It is an organization that helps people who are living with HIV and AIDS who are homeless or low income. So doing a lot of really good things in the past, you know, 28 years. And people are probably familiar with them through their thrift shops and the Housing Works bookstore downtown. Mm-hmm. So those places all actually do take different things like furniture or clothes or books. And when they sell things through their thrift shops or their bookstores, 100% of those profits go straight back into the work that they're doing. So helping people, you know, with medical needs, helping people find housing and things like that. So that's one thing to do if you, you know, find yourself with a lot of books and you want to take them somewhere. You could go to the Housing Works bookstore and donate them there. There are, of course, conditions on what they
accept. They're very particular, yeah. And that's not a criticism, it's just a fact.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I found interesting when I was researching this piece is that they don't take furniture that's made with wood composites. So that's something you find a lot in IKEA furniture, for example. So if you have like a stray IKEA table, they probably wouldn't take that. But you can look on their website and find a very thorough and extensive list of what they will and will not take.
Grow NYC. This seems really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
What's Grow NYC?
Grow NYC is the organization that runs all of the green markets in the city. So if you've been to the Union Square Green Market or the one at Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn, they're the ones who are facilitating those. And that's not the only thing they do. They also have programs that help, you know, beautify community gardens throughout the city. They have workshops with kids and different things like that to just kind of make people aware of the environmental impact and things that they're doing in the city. And it's a great organization. If you love the green markets, they're a good one to donate to.
Let's talk to Judy from Queens, who's called in. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. A while back, and I can't find the receipt that with the actual name of the place, but I donated a bunch of clothes for women who were homeless who were going on job interviews.
Dress for Success.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. I knew you would know. And it's a wonderful thing.
They're great.
Beautiful thing. Because, when women leave with the clothes on their back and their kids, what are they going to do?
Yeah, it's a wonderful organization.
It really is. And the woman who started it, I think it was her grandmother left her like $10,000 and told her to go out and do good in the world.
Mm.
And that's what she started it with. It's a cool story.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling in, Judy. I know that they do great work. Is this a good time of year to give blood, by the way, Amy?
I think every time of year is a good time of year.
How do I find if I qualify? I guess that's a better question.
Yeah, so there's the New York Blood Center, and they do a lot of collecting of blood and platelets to, give out to people who need them in hospitals and medical centers. They have a list on their website of what will make someone eligible. There are a lot of different things that make you ineligible, whether you've recently gotten a tattoo, if you've been sick, if you're pregnant, if you're on certain medications. So it's always a good idea to check that list out at New York Blood Center before you make any plans to do that.
Let's go on to the volunteering list. City Meals on Wheels.
Mm-hmm. City Meals on Wheels is a great organization. They do a lot of work with homebound and elderly New Yorkers. You can help them by signing up for a shift to do food prep. You can sign up to help deliver items to people in their homes. You can sign up to help them with office work, things like, addressing postage and things like that. So there are a lot of different ways to help there.
Do I need to have a car if I want to be part of the delivery team?
No. So this is kind of cool. They work with senior centers in different neighborhoods to do food prep and things like that. And you actually, when you sign up for a shift, you'll actually walk to a person's home and deliver the food that way. So you don't need to have a car to do that.
This one I love. A lot of people think the New York City Parks Department, it feels like a big bureaucracy. But volunteers are really important, right?
Yeah, they're really important. If you've ever been to a park and noticed trash or there's a tree that fell and it needs to be cleaned up, volunteers help with that kind of stuff. And they help maintain gardens. They help maintain street trees. You can find all of this information on how to do that on the Parks Department's website. And it's just a really great way for somebody who might have a green thumb to pitch in and do some good in the green spaces around the city.
Let's take a few more calls. Linda from the Bronx is on the line for... Hi, Linda.
Hi. I'd like to recommend a charity for consideration. I should say this. I think that some folks are looking for a way to be supportive of environmental improvement globally and in New York City. And a great organization for that purpose is the Bronx River Alliance. And part of what's great about it is it's also really a very community-led, community-based effort to improve the environment in the Bronx and create a place of real pride and enjoyment.
Linda, thank you so much for sharing that. Let's go to line 5. David in New Jersey. He wants to plug for a New Jersey charity. We've been talking all New York. Go for it, David.
Hi there. I'd like to put in a plug for the Saddle River Valley Lions Club. This is an amazing group of people who, in the course of their history over the last few decades, have raised and given away $2.5 million. There's about 30 people in the club, and 100% of what the club raises goes directly to the charities it supports. They can be reached at Post Office Box 333 Saddle River, New Jersey, or our website, and just look for Saddle River Valley Lions Club. They're terrific.
All right, Dave from New Jersey, thank you so much. And we're going to take David's word for it that this is a great charity. But Charity Navigator is a good place to go if you want to make sure your money's going where you think it's going, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good bet. And especially with local organizations, for the most part, you know that your money is going to the right place.
Right. Diane from Brooklyn is online, too. Hi, Diane.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to add?
I wanted to say that an amazing organization to volunteer with is the New Sanctuary Coalition. The volunteer work is being part of a group that accompanies prospective citizens, people, immigrants, to hearings at courts, ICE hearings, check-ins. There are different levels of when people have to go back and forth. And the New Sanctuary Coalition arranges for between 4 and 10 people to accompany each one of these people to a hearing, just basically to be supportive, to be part of their community. And it's looked on usually very favorably by the people who are doing the hearings, although you're not necessarily allowed in with the person, but you are there. Your presence is felt.
Great. We appreciate it, Diane, so much. I want to get to a couple more things before I let you go. We're talking to Amy Plitt. She's an editor at Curb New York, and she's put together this great, great compilation of places to volunteer and to donate. Animal lovers who want to get in on this, where should they go?
Yeah, so there are a lot of animal shelters and charities throughout the city. One that I really like and included in this piece is BARC, the Brooklyn Animal Resource Coalition. It's in Williamsburg in Brooklyn. They have programs where you can help walk dogs during the day. They especially need people for morning shifts. You know, people might want to sign up in the evening after work, but they really need morning helpers. So you're walking with dogs, you know, socializing with them and stuff like that. They also have a cat loft, so cat lovers can get in on this too, of which I am one. So they have programs during the day where you can socialize with cats before they get adopted out, which is really nice. You just kind of sit around and play with cats for like a couple hours, which sounds like my idea of heaven. So.
And at the end of your article, you have something that says, take action.
Mm-hmm.
If people have heard this and it's just, you know, you're not sure what you want to do, what does take action mean?
Yeah, so we at Curb New York really love to try and get people to engage with their communities, and volunteering and donating your time is one really great way to do it. There are a lot of other ways, though. You can get involved with your community board. You know, we just passed the Charter Review Commission changes to the community boards passed this year in the general election, and that's going to really change the process of getting involved with those. So you can do that. You can go to Landmarks Preservation Commission hearings and weigh in on landmarks that are happening or maybe getting designated throughout the city. You know, the city itself has a website called NYC Service that gives people a lot of different ways to donate time, donate money, just to get involved with different communities. So there are just so many different ways that you can become a more engaged New Yorker and help your fellow New Yorkers.
And Jeff on line four has one more way. He's going to finish out our segment for us. Jeff, what's your advice?
I'm on several nonprofit boards, and that's all wonderful. But the most gratifying thing that I do every morning is to get up and walk into Prospect Park and pick up garbage. If I see a homeless person, I have a few minutes. I'll ask if they want a cup of coffee or a bite of food. Just chatting with people on the street, helping people with their packages. This stuff is so basic and so rewarding, but it spreads love.
Just be a good person.
That's such a great thing. People always see New Yorkers as being really like aggressive and mean and uncaring, and it's just obviously not true because of things like that.
Amy Plitt, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your lists.
Thank you so much for having me.
Next on All of It, we're talking to Lucas Hedges. He's in 2 films and theaters now, and also he just made his Broadway debut. We'll talk about his life growing up in New York City, his acting career, which has just exploded. This is All of It on WNYC. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. A few years back, Lucas Hedges had one of those breakthrough years for a young actor. two roles in two highly acclaimed films, both nominated for multiple Academy Awards, Lady Bird and Manchester by the Sea. He was nominated for an Oscar for the latter. It doesn't seem like a year like that could repeat itself, right? Well, it happened in an even bigger way this year. Lucas Hedges was just nominated for a Golden Globe for his starring role in Boy Erased, a true story of a young man whose parents send him to gay conversion therapy. He's got another film out now, Ben is Back. He stars a young man who struggles with opioid addiction. His mom, played by Julia Roberts, tries to help him after he chooses to leave rehab early. I don't know, he was also in the film Mid-90s released this fall. And on top of that, he made his Broadway debut this year. He is currently starring in the Waverly Gallery, Kenneth Lonergan's autobiographical play about a family struggling to cope with a family member, a vibrant, bon vivant matriarch who is slowly succumbing to dementia. The Waverly Gallery is playing through January 27th. Boy Erased and Ben is Back are both in studios. Lucas, you found time to come visit us. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Are you worn out? Are you a tired guy?
I honestly feel, the more I get to do, the more energy I have. And I feel kind of like there's just consistently stuff. There are like a lot of waves for me to ride. That's what it feels like. So I'm not somebody who does well with time off right now, so I'm enjoying it.
It's kind of interesting. When you slow down, it's sort of inertia kind of sets in a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's good for especially, I think, people who have a lot of energy.
Yeah, exactly.
To keep going.
Exactly. I never figured out how to not work, which I need to figure out because it's a lot of the actor's life is how do you fill time in between jobs.
And you're young and you don't want to burn out.
I know.
That's the other
true,
part of that
true.
Story. So Kenneth Lonergan was here and we had a really nice long conversation about Waverly Gallery. And I wonder what kind of conversations you had, because that play is autobiographical and you are playing Kenneth Lonergan.
Yeah.
And this was his experience with his family of his grandmother who slowly, you know, a lot of people obviously are dealing with this.
Yes.
What kind of conversations did you guys have?
Well, a lot of our conversations were about Kenny's a very dry person.
Yes.
With his humor and just his state of being. He's not really a hyperbolic person at all, which I come from a very hyperbolic family that really always wants to make you feel good, like constantly sort of caretaking. And I think a lot of the character's differences from me are in his dryness and just in the fact that when he says something that has weight, it has weight. It's not like everything has weight, which is sort of, I don't know, it's some of my upbringing is sort of like imbuing everything with so much meaning that Kenny doesn't have as much to the sense, in the sense that when he says one thing, when he says something profound and meaningful, it really lands and it has a potency to it. So that was part of my work.
You spend a lot of time on stage with a legend, with
Elaine
May.
Yeah.
What have you learned from her?
Oh, God. You know, it's interesting. I feel like sometimes the people that I could be learning from most, I actually just get to, it's more of just a thrill to get to be around them and to watch them, because what's so brilliant about Elaine is that she's found her way. She really found her way, and it's not going to be my way. Like, my way is going to be very different. So I rarely work with somebody and go, oh, that's how I do it. You know, I just see them in their glory. And I get it just makes my job easier for the time being. You know, I don't have to work as hard because I get to just look at her. But but I don't know. I want to take improv classes now. I'd say that, because it feels like a lot of the brilliance of her performance is rooted in, I think, her improv history with improv. And
that's interesting. Yeah,
there's never a repeated moment with her. It's all different.
Oh, that's got to be really kind of energizing as an actor.
Yeah, very much. Very, very much.
You don't get bored.
Mm-mm.
You know it's coming.
Never. Never.
In the play, also, you address the audience.
You're
letting us know about this family's life and what's going on with you all internally. Do you actually see, can you see us? And what's that like for you as you address the audience?
I love this question, because this is what I was most worried about going in. I can see pretty much the first three rows, and then everyone else is in silhouette, unless you have binoculars or have glasses, in which case you're just a dark figure with glasses. Or everybody looks pretty like looming and ominous, which is a little frightening. But I can't really.
Is it make you nervous at all when you make eye contact, or do people make eye contact with you?
I like to make eye contact with people because my favorite moments are when I can literally just tell them. It's great because it takes me out of it, then informs all the other scenes in that it makes me act less in the scenes, and it makes it just about okay, I'm communicating this to you. And I think the best actors just simply speak to each other. So it's a good opportunity to get back, ground myself in that.
Now, you're a native New Yorker. Broadway is not this mystical place like to folks who come from Nebraska or Iowa.
Yeah.
But what was magical about it for you once you got there? Because you grew up in it.
Yeah.
You're from a family of actors and directors. And
Well, I went to my favorite theatrical experience I've ever had in New York was I went and saw the Normal Heart at the Gold, which is at the theater we're doing the Waverly Gallery in. And I went backstage and I saw the dressing rooms. And it's the thing that really first made me romantic about Broadway. And so there is a magic to it. But yeah, my dad was a playwright. My mom was an actress in theater. And it feels kind of more like like the family tradition in some sense that, you know, some kids are passed down, become lawyers or doctors. And, you know, for us, it was theater and acting.
We're talking to Lucas Hedges.
Go for it.
We're talking to Lucas Hedges about the Waverly Gallery, as well as Ben Is Back and Boy Erased. Let's talk about Ben Is Back. So the story is that it's Christmas Eve, and your character, Ben, we see him in the driveway of his family home, and he's clearly troubled and trouble. He's both. Mm. Julia Roberts plays your mom. You've left rehab. I think all of us, I know you've answered this question before because this shows you how sad and prevalent this is. Everybody is one step away from somebody who's dealt with some sort of addiction, especially including opioid addiction. Did you go to real life experiences? Did you read about it? Did you talk to friends and families who've dealt with it?
Yeah. I went to a lot of AA and NA meetings. I have friends who are in these programs who I spoke to and tried to hear about their stories. But for I think the single most defining factor of anybody who struggles with addiction is that these substances are an attempt to get away from whatever it is they're feeling on a daily basis. So for the most part, most of my work is about just becoming very familiar with my own shame, the things that I try to escape in myself. And magnify and turn the volume up on him so that I can understand the extremes of why this character needs to use.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of subtleties in this movie. And one of them, I think, even though it's not necessarily a subtle scene, is Julia Roberts, your mom in the film, confronts the doctor that prescribed you opioids. For an accident. Skiing.
Yes, snowboarding.
Snowboarding
skiing,
accident.
I think
it was just sort of that sense of this can happen to anyone. That this is we're at the place when the nicest kids you know, not that being addicted to anything doesn't make you a nice person, sort of someone you assume is stable and has this great life can have all these troubles.
Yeah.
I thought that was such an important thing that the movie tells you.
Yeah, I think it's something that it's a very real for my family with me and my dad's side. It's a very personal story for him in particular. There are people in his immediate circle whose lives have been threatened by addiction, and it felt like a story that there was a greater purpose in it. In terms of how relatable it is for, I mean, really everyone in the world now. Yeah.
Julia Roberts in the film plays your mom, and she's like ferocious mom in the best way.
Really
like she
ferocious.
Just really, really is one of those women, and I think most moms are like this. You just have this spidey sense about your kid. And you guys have terrific chemistry. Did you know each other before?
I didn't know her. I felt like I knew her because, you know, I feel like everyone feels like they know her or the actors that they grow up with. But when I met her, we spent a week getting to know each other at her place in California and just we really got along. And she sent, before I signed on to do the movie, she sent a photo of her and her redheaded son. Her oldest son is a redhead, to my dad, being like, look, just so he knows, I'm very comfortable with redheaded men. Like, in like a very, it was a very sweet gesture. And something about that, and the fact that she had her son Finn, I felt like she had a maternal connection to me because she could relate the two of us together, or see us as similar. And for that reason, I felt like her son, and I felt loved by her in a very special way. And that helped encourage those maternal feelings for me.
You mentioned about your dad writing and directing and obviously on this film. And I know you used to go watch him when you were a kid on sets. What was the difference between watching him and working with him? Because you'd seen him work before and you knew how he worked.
Yeah. God. Well, I guess I felt like I was meeting him on the same level now. It was like before he was always this person who was off in this, you know, he's like my dad, he's a giant. And he was doing this thing, he was making movies with actors that I, when I was a little kid, I'd see him working with these actors and I thought he was the greatest thing ever. And now I've gotten some, I had some movies under my belt and I sort of felt like I know what works for me and I know what doesn't. So he was my collaborator. He really was, and we had to sever the ties of father-son relationship, and he had to be my director. So it was very humanizing.
We're talking to Lucas Hedges. He's starring in The Waverly Gallery, as well as Ben Is Back and Boy Erased. Boy Erased, you got your Golden Globe nomination. It's a true story. How familiar were you with the story?
I knew nothing about Garrod's story, but I had a faint understanding of what conversion therapy looked like. I mean, in that it seeks to convert people's sexuality and gender identity. But I really didn't know anything about the specifics of what these programs look like. And yeah, so it was uncharted ground.
When I was reading reviews of the film, and this is a word I thought I wrote down in my notebook, the word nuanced comes up a lot about your performance.
Nice.
You're like, I like that one.
Good.
I'm good with that one. Can you think or explain a couple different ways that you worked in something that was subtle into your performance, but it was really important for you to do?
Well, most of the character, that's the character was tricky for me because he spends most of the movie in silence, and most of the scenes are him having internal reactions to things that are happening in front of him. So I never thought about it as the idea of, oh, this needs to be nuanced or this needs to be subtle, as much as just, I think any genuine and inner life is naturally that way. So I tried to just focus on what those things meant to me, I guess. I mean, I have an allergy to like loud reactions to very animated performances in realistic worlds. So I think if anything, I just really strayed away from anything that seemed too broad. But I guess that's my answer.
In Boy Erased, Nicole Kidman plays your mother, and again, another ferocious mom, but in a different way. And she also has this incredible struggle of wanting to protect and do what she thinks is right for her son, versus her husband and her religion, and that real push and pull. Was religion ever a factor in your life?
Oof. I was raised going to Sunday school. I would just play with like Pokemon figures in I mean 8 gram crackers, and that was pretty much and play basketball at my Sunday school. But we stopped going, and I really never went to church. But recently, I'm really trying to reengage with the idea of a higher power and of a God of some kind. Although a God can be a tree or a nature. You know, I don't have any attachment to an idea of what it looks like in my head.
We've been talking about ferocious moms and all this, and when you Google you and Academy Awards, a picture of you and your mom comes up. Tell me about your mom.
Oh, yes. Okay. So my mom's sort of like this unsung hero of our family. I mean, and I would say that, I don't know, she's sort of just been like, she's
Beautiful. No. She's a lovely, woman.
I have specific things I want to say about her, and I don't want this silence to be deceiving in any way. But I feel like my mom is like the most solid connection I've had over the course of my entire life, in that she's everything my mom tells me I believe. And that means so much more than what it sounds like, in the sense that I feel like I have a deep trust of my mother. And I don't know. I just feel my relationship with her growing every year. And I really love her. I guess that's, yeah.
It's very sweet. The pictures, you can tell you're both so proud of each other in those pictures.
I love my mom.
back to the acting part.
Yeah,
I just
please.
Thought about moms and your mom.
No, that's a good question.
What was it like for you going from becoming the lead? This is a year when you are the lead, man.
God, stressful. Really, really stressful. But that's where I have to I have to choose material that I love, because if I don't love it, then it'll kill me. Like in the sense that I won't like doing it. I'll have so much self-doubt. So I have to be distracted by the project out of myself, you know? So that's what I turn to in those moments of, okay, I'm the lead. Forget about that. What's the story we're telling? And both of these stories have clear purposes that are greater than myself. So that's sort of what I turn to.
Obviously, this film, Boy Erased, is going to be emotional for a lot of people who are watching it, people who've been sent to these kind of camps, somebody whose family maybe has not accepted them, has expelled them. Obviously, the film's getting a lot of support from the LGBTQ community. Can you share something someone has said to you that has been really meaningful?
I feel like I know what you might... Never mind. I thought maybe
that was a genuine question.
I thought maybe there was like some sort of like you're like giving me the alley oop or something.
No, I know what you think, but no. I'm just really interested if someone has said something to you that
with respect to conversion therapy, or just over the course of this film.
Yeah, what the film's meant, or talking about these kind of stories.
I guess I don't know. It's difficult to put into words. I feel like being in this movie and getting to work so closely with Garrett and with Joel and with everyone involved, it's a similar feeling to witnessing something beautiful in nature, in the sense that like if you take a trip and like see the aurora borealis or whatever, I imagine what you would take away wouldn't put into words as much as it would have like a literal impact on you. And I feel like just orbiting around these people who have grounded their lives in fighting the fight of personal triumph, their own personal triumphs and their own identities. It creates a momentum for me moving forward in my life to go, I'm not doing this. I'm not taking this. And I'm going to choose this for myself, because that's how I'm going to become most embodied, you know? So that's sort of what I took from it.
What are your next couple projects?
Right now I have nothing, which I'm very excited about.
He's got the biggest smile on his face.
I have two that are coming out.
Tell me the ones
I can tell you about that. So I did this movie. Shia LaBeouf wrote a movie about his relationship with his father. And I play a character that's very much based on him. And it takes place in what would have been the Even Stevens era of his life, and then jumps forward to like his 20s. And I'm him in his 20s. A really, really life-changing, really, really life-changing experience. And I got to work with this director, Alma Harrell, who's a documentarian, and just... really feel like I found the people some people I want to work with for a long time moving forward.
And number two?
Number two is, so there's a filmmaker named Trey Edward Schultz who did a movie called Krisha and then another movie called It Comes at Night. And he's one of my favorite young American filmmakers, and he reached out to me when he was writing the script, and we got together and really vibed. And so I signed on, and then it's sort of it's like an epic film of a similar proportion to like Magnolia, Boogie Nights, or Place Beyond the Pines. Yeah, exactly. Right. Just compare it to all the great movies, and it's like that, you know. But it's sort of an epic film about high schoolers in Florida, and I don't know. It has a scope to it that's similar to like a Terrence Malick film. It sort of ends up being about life and the passage of time, and yeah, it really, really excites me.
You really like movies. You really like film.
I do. I do love
film. I can tell by the way you talk about it.
I love I think film's the most, it's the medium that I connect with most. I wish I could be a musician, to be totally honest. I would rather be a musician than an actor. I just don't got it in me. So, I don't know, there's a purity to the musical art form. But film is great because you can have music in it too, and you can have, tell stories about, I don't know, it's my thing.
The acting thing is going to be okay, though.
Lucas. Yeah, I do love acting.
Lucas Hedges stars in the Waverly Gallery on Broadway through January 27th. He's also in Ben Is Back and Boy Erased. Lucas, thank you so much for coming
thank
in.
You
I really
for
appreciate
having
it.
Me. Yeah, I appreciate being here.
Stick around. All of it will be right back. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. And now time for sport. With snowy weather coming back in full force as we near the end of the year, it can be tempting to stay curled up by the fire with a book and a hot cup of cocoa. But perhaps we should all take a page from alpine ski racer Lindsey Vonn, who just announced she's not retiring just yet after a sports injury. She's going to go back on the slopes. So if you're trying to get back on the slopes, but you could use a refresher course, we have some good news for you, especially the ladies. All female ski camps are a thing. Writer and editor and skier Elizabeth Venticelli wrote two pieces for the New York Times, How to Get the Most Out of Women's Ski Camp and 5 Women-Only Ski Camps That Will Help You Shred Better. Elizabeth, welcome.
Hi.
So why is there a need for these camps, these all-female camps?
Well, they started maybe like 10, 15 years ago, but they're really reaching a critical mass now where there's really a lot of demand for them. Pretty much every resort in North America has one or more than one in many cases. They're incredibly popular, and I think there's two reasons for that. One is there's a generation of women that wants to keep on skiing and wants to spend time with other women. You know, some of them are maybe empty nesters. Mm-hmm. And they just want refreshers, as you say, or they just want to improve their skills. And there's also a very big social element, like hanging out with others who share their passion.
So when you go to one of these ski camps, what's the goal? Is it the goal to get better by the end? Is it to advance? What do you think?
It's all that, actually. I mean, for me personally, it really was to deal with some, like, skiing is a very mental sport. You're basically doing mm-hmm. this insane thing of like throwing yourself down an icy slope, which is completely counterintuitive because you're like, I can tell you there's many times when I've thought, like, why am I doing this? This is crazy. But it's incredibly satisfying, and I just want to keep on doing it. So I want to, you just never stop learning. And I actually had seen, when I was skiing at Alta in Utah, I had seen some of these classes, those all-women groups, and they looked like they were having so much fun. I thought, like, I kind of would love to do that. And also, so yes, it's a technical aspect, like refreshing your skills, but mm-hmm. it's also hanging out with women who share what is really a passion.
You wrote that, quote, I tend to underestimate my abilities. This is a common problem among women. Men have the exact opposite and affects your skiing technique since the sport requires decisiveness and confidence. Could you explain a little bit more about that?
Well, yes. So skiing, as I said, is kind of intuitive. You have to, if you want to improve your skills, you really have to throw yourself down the slope, mm-hmm. which your brain tells you, no, hang back. You're going to lose control. Actually, it's the exact opposite. The more you throw yourself down, the more control you have. But you have to battle your own maybe lack of self-confidence, this idea that you can't do it and this makes no sense and it's scary. And so a lot of skiing is really getting over those mental things, which I think is really a problem for a lot of women, where we tend to hold back. We're not confident saying, I want this, I can do this. And those camps are really good for that because the whole thing, what they drill into your head, at least this particular one did, and I think it's the same for most of them, is that, yes, you can do this. You can battle your fear. You can, you have better technique than you think you have. And men, this is completely anecdotal, but I think there's also actually like psychological studies that support that. Men tend to be a little overconfident. And in skiing, overconfidence can really get you in trouble. It's actually, it's a dangerous sport. Mm-hmm. So you have to strike that balance of having confidence but knowing your limits. And the camps are very good for that.
And it also sounds like the camp provides a very supportive environment for women who might be a little frightened or might be fear making a mistake and having the guys laugh at them on the slopes.
Right. There's some of that. I mean, I know, again, I'm going to draw from my own experience, but I think it's pretty common. So I was put in the most advanced group. And my first reaction was like, oh, God, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no. How am I, you know? And then I saw the other one in the group and I was like, oh, my God, they're so good. I'm never going to. And then it was okay. And there was a particularly gnarly moment when I was pretty scared. And so I made it down in one piece. And then I told the instructor, I said, I was really scared up there. And she said, I could tell. It was visible, but I knew you could do it. And I thought, okay, well, if she thinks I can do it, but then I can do it. And it really like helped a lot. And I've been, it was kind of like a game changer for me, that conversation. I was like, yeah, I can do that. And I think it's the same for a lot of others or in those groups where you're really, and I mean, but you know what? The bottom line is like, it's a ton of fun.
Yeah.
It's really, it's a ton of fun.
We're talking to Elizabeth Vincentelli about her experience at a ski camp, a women-only ski camp. She wrote two pieces for the Times about it. I want your thought on ski gear, because they used to have this thing where they called it shrinked and pinked.
Yes. Shrink it and pink it.
How has this changed?
I think partly it's a very bottom line oriented decision. Oh, wow, women are buying stuff. Let's sell women's stuff, you know, and they're not content with the men version, but just, you know, pink or pastel color. They want stuff that's really thought. Men have a different, you know, center of gravity. Women have different center. Women have a different foot. You can't buy the same shoes, the same boots for men and women. And so then several companies really put their money where their mouth was, and they really started like women-specific gear lines. They were taking women's and their athletic capabilities very seriously. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, double bonus for them. They made a lot of money doing that. And it's proven they're right. There really is a market of women who want to be taken seriously and they take their sport seriously.
Now, the price tag for these camps. Well, steep? I guess it depends on who you are. What is the price tag? I won't even put any sort of judgment on it.
No. I mean, skiing, it's not jogging. You have to go to, you know, a specific place. You have to buy specific gear. The upside is that it lasts a long time, so you can use it for a while. But so the particular camp that I went to was about, I think, $3,000 for 3 days and four nights. But that includes absolutely everything you can think of. But there's a lot cheaper ones, you know, that include only maybe instruction. So you're not locked in into lodgings or... So there, it covers a very wide ground, actually.
I was reading up this one website, which is a sort of a hub for women skiers, made the point that more women see other women doing rad things on skis, the more other females will be inspired to get out there and push themselves. Do you believe this philosophy?
Well, totally. I mean, I saw those groups of women like looking like they were having great fun, and they were going on pretty, you know, rad like trails. And I thought, like, I totally want to do that. And mind you, I love skiing with my male friends. It's not that at all. But sometimes you just want a little bit of a change of pace. I've made great friends, you know, in 3 days, which was great. A lot of women are frustrated also because when they go on a ski vacation with their family, they end up being locked into the role they always play. Who has to cook? Who has to bring the kids to ski school? it's not going to be the husband.
Right.
It's usually the woman.
So it's actually vacation if you go on one of these camps.
Right, exactly. And that actually, several of them told me, it's like, oh my God, it's a vacation for my, obviously they love their families. It's not that, you know, but
oh,
nobody
no. we
questions.
All need a break.
Nobody questions the dudes when they go on their fishing trips. You know, it's established, mm-hmm. you know, like nobody questioned their love for their family. And it's the same for these women. It's like, I've earned it. This is my 3 days for me. I'm going to have my Chardonnay at the end of the day, which, you know, people partake.
Yes. Well, you have to have a little, après-ski. That's what the lodge is about.
It's incredibly fun. And I have to say, unfortunately, it's incredibly addictive. I say, unfortunately, for my bank account. No, it's a wonderful sport. And it's a great bonding experience.
I bet. We're going to link to your article. I think we actually already have, but we'll do it again. Elizabeth Vencentelli, thank you so much. The name of her article is, I lost it. It's about women's ski camps, and it's
yeah,
pretty great.
Yeah, look it up. It's really easy to find.
It's in that little paper called the New York Times. You've heard of it. Thanks. That's our show. Thanks for listening to All of It. You can follow All of It on Instagram and Twitter at All of It WNYC. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.